Quel est le point de métal?
Hello, wrestling fans, and welcome to Shut Up and Wrestle, a wrestling history podcast about good conversations and great stories. I am your host, Brian R. Solomon, and welcome to episode 111 of Shut Up and Wrestle with my guest this week, Colin Hunter of Kayfabe News. Before we get to that multi-layered conversation that's on the way, a couple of things that I wanted to get to and wanted to mention first. Feels like we've been doing a lot of remembering and obituaries of lost legends, unfortunately, and we've got another one this week as we recently learned of the passing of Paul Butcher Vachon at the age of 86. Now, Butcher Vachon had a career that spanned decades. Of course, he's probably best remembered as one half of the tag team that he formed with his brother, Maurice Mad Dog Vachon. Butcher Vachon, also the adopted father of Luna Vachon, the brother of Vivian Vachon, and a promoter in his own right, promoted wrestling in Quebec for years in the early 70s. He and his brother were the first promoters to bring Andre the Giant to North America back in the day in the early 70s. And I believe he is one of the very last of the territorial promoters who are still with us. As far as I can think, the only remaining would be Bill Watts. Although anybody that is listening, I'm sure will be quick to correct me if I'm leaving anybody out. But regardless of that, Paul Butcher Vachon, we commemorate his passing, and our thoughts and prayers are with his fans, his family, and his friends. Also want to mention issue number 43 of Inside the Ropes, which is currently on pre-sale, meaning you can order it at InsideTheRopesMagazine.com. You can pre-order it. It's got Sting on the cover, and inside there's an article that I did on a lot of the corporate shakeups going on in the world of professional wrestling recently. Of course, most notably, the final, it appears to be, removal of Vince McMahon from power in WWE, as well as Scott D'Amore parting ways with TNA Wrestling, Rossi Ogawa leaving Stardom, Hiroshi Tanahashi becoming the new president of New Japan Pro Wrestling. A lot of shakeups at the top in professional wrestling in the last couple of months. And you can get that article in the new issue, issue 43 of Inside the Ropes. Now, without further ado, I'd like to get to this week's conversation. Colin Hunter, as I mentioned, is the man behind Kayfabe News. He's also done a lot more than that. You'll hear that in the interview, in the conversation I'm about to share with you, which really goes everywhere. This was so much fun for me to do. You know, of course, we talked about things like the role of satire and parody in pro wrestling, the responsibilities of being a wrestling referee, which Colin has also done, and he'll talk about in this episode. And the conversation goes all over the place into areas like anything from Shakespeare to quantum physics and all points in between. I think you're going to love it. I'm going to take you to it right now. Okay, so it's my pleasure this week on Shut Up and Wrestle to welcome a very interesting individual. I have with me here maybe the only person who has ever collaborated with both Stu Sachs and Stephen Hawking. We'll talk about that. He has worked in the field of theoretical physics, but we're not really going to spend a lot of time on that today. Surprise, we're going to talk about wrestling. He's written for Pro Wrestling Illustrated. That's the Stu Sachs part. He is also one of the filmmakers behind an interesting film that I want to talk about called The Ref Didn't See It, which is all about, you guessed it, referees in wrestling. But most people know him as Kayfabe Colin, the man behind the self-described pro wrestling version of The Onion. It is wrestling's Onion. We know it as Kayfabe News, and the man is Colin Hunter. Colin, thank you so much for being a guest on the show.
Thank you so much for that introduction. I actually have never put Stu Sachs and Stephen Hawking together in the same sentence, but it's true. And that's actually, both of them were people that I like looked up to and admired and thought, those are untouchables. Like Stu Sachs as much as Stephen Hawking, because he was the name behind a wrestling magazine, which for some time was, it seemed impenetrable to me until I started working for him.
And not only that, but like you've said, because, you know, I do a little research and you know, on the guests that I'm having on the show, but he was responsible for crafting the tone of that magazine, which I write for them now, even though Stu is retired, but I did write for them back then as well. And that's a magazine that's known for the very specific kind of tone that it cultivated and that influenced a lot of people like me. When I went to WWE Magazine, and we had other people there that had been wrestling magazine fans, we then tried, I've told those guys this, we tried to copy PWI and Inside Wrestling and The Wrestler. That's the tone that we were trying to copy in WWE Magazine, which I don't know if Vince wanted that, but that's what we wanted, so.
Well, I was always told, treat it like it's the Sports Illustrated of wrestling. Write about it like that. And I would sometimes, so, you know, writing for PWI was where I started to learn to write in the kayfabe style, to write about the fiction of wrestling as if it's real, which is kind of what evolved into Kayfabe News. But at PWI, there were times when I was finding too much humor and too much levity. And I think Stu would have to say, you know what, Colin, tone it down a bit. You know, we're a serious, and it's, he was right. You know, that the tone was always, this is a respectable, perhaps the most respectable sport, the sport of kings, and we are going to cover it as such, with that serious tone. And that's how Kayfabe News still covers it, you know, with this deadpan journalistic, yeah, tone that I picked up being an actual newspaper writer, but then also working at PWI and Inside Wrestling and all those.
Yeah, well, it's not dry in the sense of dry as in boring, but it's dry humor in the sense that it doesn't blink. It's not, the point of view is very, very serious, and that's where the humor comes from. But I mean, I think one of the reasons too that they were going for that respectability in PWI is, as we know, before PWI, the Stanley Weston magazines were kind of sordid. I mean, they would have always blood on the cover, apartment wrestling on the inside, these really sensational, outrageous kind of stories. You know, Gorilla Monsoon wants to shoot Bruno Sammartino being one of the infamous ones.
Or Kamala wanting Hulk Hogan's head on a spike.
Oh, God. I think that actually was a PWI cover.
But yeah, it was. They photoshopped Hulk Hogan's head onto a spike. It was crazy.
They were trying to move away from that. I think, you know, by the time you get to the mid-80s and wrestling's mainstream, and I think the distributors wanted something a little different. And that's what he did. I used to call it Kayfabe Light. And tell me if this makes sense to you, because I used the same approach when I wrote my first book for WWE, which is WWE Legends, where I couldn't really break kayfabe. But what they would do, and that's, it's all out the window now in PWI, but I mean, what they used to do in those magazines is they would acknowledge things like that there were good guys and bad guys, right? Which the companies would never acknowledge outright. They would have, say, fan favorite, rule breaker. They would acknowledge when guys had been in other companies, which is something you didn't usually hear on TV. They would acknowledge even when they would adapt different personas. That was something that would be talked about. But they would never acknowledge that the matches were predetermined. It was always, this is a genuine competition. The titles are real. Yeah. So it was like kayfabe, but not as strict as the actual wrestling promotions would cultivate.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was... You know, I had to be smartened up a little bit by Stu himself. with my very first assignment with PWI, because I grew up, those magazines are the reason I knew that there was other wrestling aside from WWF. Like,
right.
Until I walked into a convenience store and thumbed through those magazines, I assumed that pro wrestling was WWF. I only had the one channel and it only came on Saturdays. And so when I started writing for them, I knew that they were treating wrestling more serious than WWF because they were talking about other promotions. And I'd see these names in these lists of AWA and NWA. Like, I didn't know who these people were until I saw little black and white photos in the magazine. So I knew the magazines were doing something resembling journalism, but I didn't know where the kayfabe sort of kicked in. So Stu Sachs over the phone gave me my first assignment about the Dudley Boys, and the idea, the conceit of the story was that Spike is trying to get redemption to rejoin, to truly become a Dudley again. I forget, something like that. But I said to Stu, so should I book an interview with the Dudleys, or how do I? And he's like, well, I got to tell you something about the magazines here. We don't actually have to do the interviews. But what I thought was brilliant about the magazines all along was that the big wrestling promotions saw it as free publicity as long as they stuck enough to the storylines, like kayfabe light. They would never post a picture of two mortal enemies traveling in a car together.
Right.
And they would never say, this match, it went short because so-and-so was disgruntled about his payday. They'd never got into that. So I love that even as a kid who sort of grew up on the magazines, the editor himself had to say, you know, kid, you don't have to do an interview if you want to write about these people. And then the ultimate satisfaction was they print this story and it's got quotes from all the Dudleys. And then I showed it to several of the Dudley boys themselves. And they're like, they didn't say that, but they got it. If the magazines are upping the stories and promoting what the wrestling companies want them to promote, then there's very little for them to complain about. It really is sort of free advertising.
Yeah. And that's certainly the way they always did look at it. But they would, with the interviews, obviously that's something that's changed now where they really do the interviews.
They were doing some of them at the time, which was also part of the beauty of the kayfabe, where there was some real interviews and some weren't. And even when I went to visit the PWI offices in Bluebell, Pennsylvania, they even tried to, like, they kayfabed me on the spot. They said, oh, Matt Brock, he sits over there, but he's out of the office right now. And you know, that's so-and-so's old desk. Who's another?
Liz Hunter.
Liz Hunter, which happened to be my mom's name. They would say, oh, yeah, Liz Hunter, she's just out for lunch right now. I love that idea that the magazines had their own kayfabe that gets built into the mythology. And of course, I also grew up reading WWF magazine. And that was another, like, some sort of magical publication, like a Bible of sorts for a kid who loved wrestling. And for me, in journalism, as a kid, I was thinking, if I dream big, I could go to the New York Times, or if I dream even bigger, WWF magazine. Like, that was the pinnacle of journalism.
I thought the same way.
I have a different perspective.
No, I was sending all my clips. It was this crazy thing. And like, I joked to people, for me, the goal was always Pro Wrestling Illustrated. WWE was like the compromise, even though in reality, what I didn't know at 20 years old is WWE is going to pay you much better than going to work, for Stanley Weston or whoever. But at the time, I didn't get all that. And I always loved how they would find ways to rationalize anything. Like, that's what I mean by the kayfabe light. Like, a great example for me was Ted DiBiase. Like, I remember when Ted DiBiase became the Million Dollar Man, right, in the WWF, they weren't going to pretend that he never wrestled anywhere before because they were covering him in Mid-South and the UWF, and this is the same Ted DiBiase. So they came up with an explanation, do you remember this, of how he became rich. There was a whole story of that he got an inheritance or something, and obviously WWF never bothered with any of this because they had just repackaged him. But PWI, they found a way, and the other sister magazines, to not insult their fans, who they know had read about Ted DiBiase in their pages. So they had to explain how suddenly he's this wealthy guy flashing money around.
Yeah. I love that they sort of added to the mystery, too. No one's, especially in the, 70s and 80s, no one was quite sure. There was this suspicion that the fix was in on wrestling, but wait, these magazines are covering it, and those guys are covered in blood, and they seem to be real mad at each other.
Right.
So they were part of the illusion, especially, pre-internet. It literally was every week, go to the convenience store and see if there's a new magazine to learn about this other branch, not just branch, the rest of the tree of wrestling that just wasn't accessible to me at the time.
Yeah, it's like a whole other satellite world of wrestling that most fans didn't, most of the more casual fans weren't even really aware of. But like, for example, when I said how, now the magazines are, I wouldn't say completely shoot, but they know that they're competing with the internet and newsletters and everything else where everything is wide open. So it certainly isn't like it used to be. And it's closer to a shoot than when we were reading it as young people, for sure. But like, for example, I'll pull the curtain back a little on this. I just had the cover story with Toni Storm a few months ago where I interviewed her, and it's completely in character. But we did that. I mean, we got on Zoom, Toni and myself, and we workshopped that thing. I mean, it was, in the old days, I would have just wrote the whole thing. And sometimes the guys and girls, they would just be like, just do it. Like, I have no idea. Did you just write it and show it to me or whatever? But we worked it out, and she was like, how does this sound? And I was like, that's great. And then I say this and you say that. I mean, it was so much fun, but it felt good because she actually was taking part in it and signing off on it. And it felt much more collaborative and certainly less of a minefield, right? Yeah. You publish something and then guys are like, what the hell is this? I never said this, not even just wrestlers, but promoters too.
Yeah. But that's fun. That means you're essentially getting to co-write a character with her. And in a way that is a throwback to the kayfabe style. Even though you talked with her, you did it in such a way to enhance the storytelling, not just be a straight up interview.
Right. It wasn't just that. Like, I think, when I first started, I don't want to make this all about me, but like when I was in college and I was covering indies in Brooklyn for my local neighborhood newspaper, just with a tape recorder and a black and white camera. I mean, a little stopwatch. I would time the matches. And this was complete,
amazing.
This was totally volunteer, but I was dumb. I mean, I don't know how else to put it. I wouldn't say I was totally a complete mark. Like, I kind of got it. I had listened to some of the radio call-in shows and the hotlines and things. I knew sort of what was up with wrestling, but not fully. And I would try to do these interviews with these guys, like in the locker room after their match, like I was Mean Gene or something, because I was trying to get a quote for the story. And I'd be like, Tony Atlas, if you could just tell me, how do you feel about the match you just had with the Kodiak Bear? And he would kind of look at me and be like, I don't know, and my girlfriend at the time would be with me and she'd be like, Bri, it's not real. Just make it up, But I'm like, I don't know. I'm trying to make it authentic. And he would try and, they would try and come up with something on the spot, but you could tell they were looking at me like, is this guy for real? Like, what is he asking me these questions for? I hadn't fully figured it out yet.
Yeah. But they experience people at every part of that spectrum. They experience people, who come up to them and more or less believe everything's real. And then they experience total cynics who are like, go backstage with their tape recorder and then just rhyme off wrestling jargon and try to sound like they blend in. So I don't think you should be embarrassed by Tony Atlas thinking, who's this naive kid? And in a way, that's kind of fun. And I've found that, so I've covered wrestling in one way or another for a long time, and been at a lot of wrestling, mostly indie wrestling shows, but only in the past year have I mostly been backstage because I'm now working as a ref at a lot of these shows. Right. And I've found, I'm in my late 40s and watched wrestling my whole life and written about it and thought about it and talked about it. And until this year, that I'm still learning stuff every moment I'm involved. Every training session I go to, I'm like, oh, that's how that works. And I,
Yes.
you know, I don't think I've been naive about wrestling, but I think there's this endless well of things you can learn about it, which is why, you know, the good ones are always still working out, still learning new moves and going to seminars. And so, yeah, I thought I knew wrestling really well. And I'd say compared to a lot of people, I do. But the more I immerse myself like right inside it, I realized that I didn't really get it. I thought I got it. And I bet in a year I'll look back and say, you know what? I didn't really get it. But maybe I'm overanalyzing. To me, now I look at wrestling the way I looked at literature in my university days, or the way I would look at art, you know, or a the I used to write theater reviews. I would go to the biggest Shakespeare festival in North America, happens to be just down the road. And so I would write theater reviews for the newspaper of these Shakespearean plays. And now when I watch wrestling, I'm watching essentially the same way. I'm watching for character development and story arcs, and not in a in sort of an academic way, but in a enjoying it in a much deeper way. I can enjoy a small kind of bad indie wrestling show just as much, maybe even more than like WrestleMania. I've been to both, and
right.
I'm just experiencing wrestling in a totally different way now that I've kind of gotten behind the curtain and performed in the ring in a small way, you know, as a ref.
It's a very different experience. And I think the refereeing part does give you a lot of insight. And by the way, I had a similar path because I did my master's thesis in Shakespeare. I did it on Richard II. So, you know, I was steeped in English literature and just comparative literature and all that stuff. And, you know, that's why I always bristle when people try to dismiss wrestling fans or stereotype them. I go, yeah, you know what? There are people that fit that stereotype. Like any other stereotype, it exists for a reason.
Yep.
But you can't just dismiss people like that. I found many, many highly intelligent people and cultured people, even in the world of the arts, who are huge and were huge wrestling fans. I mean, there's a famous story, I don't know if you ever heard, of the conductor Toscanini, Arturo Toscanini, was a fanatical wrestling fan, and his friends would be embarrassed because here he is, the maestro, and they'd go over his house and he'd be not just watching, but screaming at the television, you know, like an old grandma or something, just like infuriated. And then he'd go and conduct like the NBC Symphony Orchestra, you know, doing Mahler or whatever. But like, that's why I've never been somebody to dismiss wrestling fans. Like with any other walk of life, I judge people one to one, not as a group.
You know what that conductor was doing was feeling human emotion, and the surge and the crescendo and the ups and the downs. He was feeling it the way he feels the music. He, you know, that's what a conductor does. They internalize and then they sort of gesticulate in a way that the orchestra can pick up on. And so I actually, I'm friends with a symphony conductor. He's in San Francisco. He recently conducted the symphony with Metallica for their second
album.
And he's not a wrestling dork anymore, but he was as a kid. And I still have a poster that he gave me of it's this taxonomy of wrestling names, like thousands of wrestling names all connected by, you know, their various tangential connections to one another. So yeah, symphony orchestra conductors I've talked to. Yeah, just on this couch a few weeks ago, I did. Cody Diener was here for doing his podcast, and we were sitting here talking about our degrees in English literature and philosophy before we got into talking about, you know, greased up men in their underpants pretending to fight.
Well, you know, Glenn Jacobs Kane, he was an English major in school.
Yeah.
Yeah. And politics aside, or whatever else you want to say, I started being suspicious of him when he told me that he didn't like Ernest Hemingway. Because for me, an English major who doesn't like Ernest Hemingway and who tells me their favorite book is Lord of the Rings, which I love, but it was my favorite book like in the sixth grade. I will judge you in situations like that. Call me a snob.
I will say,
but
it is possible to get your university degree in English literature and just go to the gym all the time and become a huge muscle man. You can do both. And I think he focused on the latter, maybe.
Maybe.
You know, fair enough. He didn't want to be a professor, and he probably wasn't cut out for, well, maybe he could scare his class into obedience.
But the referee thing fascinates me, and I want to get to that, but I'm torn because I definitely want to, we'll get to it, but I definitely want to talk about kayfabe news. How could we not? Okay. And I mean, my understanding is, correct me if I'm wrong from what I've gathered, is that you have written personally every single kayfabe news article. Is that true?
Yep, that is true. Whether that's something to brag about or something to be ashamed of, I'm not sure whether I need to get a better hobby. But yeah, it's been 11 years. Oh, we just passed the anniversary. I guess it's 11 years. And yeah, I think it's 3,500 some odd phony, unreal news stories about an unreal sport, which, yeah, when I look back, it seems crazy. And you just have to break it into one day at a time chunks. And for years, yeah, I just told myself I'll publish one article a day. And sometimes I had 10 ideas in the can, and sometimes I had zero ideas and I stared at a blinking cursor for half an hour before coming up with anything. And but yes, that is true. I am I've actually turned down help a lot of times. People say they'd like to write for Kayfabe News, and 99% of the time I can tell just by the way they reach out that they cannot write for Kayfabe News because I cannot spell. But also I'm kind of protective of it, and I like the idea that it's my sort of body of work.
Now, I mean, people love it. That goes without saying. People love Kayfabe News. And I'm assuming people love it who may not even know that you're the person who does it or behind it, because it's kind of this faceless entity to a certain degree. Get that a lot, where people are like, oh, my God, you do Kayfabe News? I love Kayfabe News, like that kind of thing.
It does. It happens a lot, especially now that I'm going to a lot of shows and I'm on shows. As the referee, and I get talking to people, and you know, it comes up, or someone will introduce me and say, hey, you know, Kayfabe News, that's the guy who writes it. And I was refereeing an indie show just this past Saturday night, and there was a wrestler who came in, and he's got the look of a wrestler, cool hair, cool piercings, cool tattoos. And I was like, that dude's pretty cool. And I was slightly intimidated since high school to talk to cool people. So sue me. But anyway, we get talking because I'm not that shy. And it came up that I'm the Kayfabe News guy. And then he did that. He's like, oh my God, I'm such a huge fan. I can't believe I'm talking to you. And every time it happens, it's, you know, I deliberately kept my name off it for years and years and years because I had real jobs and I didn't really want the two to to cross. So this, the documentary that we're making will sort of be the first time I've really put my own face and name behind any of it.
And I think the badge of honor has to be, at least in my estimation, is, you know, because people will always compare it to The Onion. Like we said at the top, it's wrestling's onion. And I think you yourself even would describe it that way. So for people that, I mean, and if you're living under a rock, I mean, anyone would know The Onion. I mean, I remember when, okay, this is one of those I'm old enough to remember when The Onion was just a physical newspaper. It was an actual paper publication.
You could pick it up in newspaper boxes.
I used to get it at in the Film Forum, which is a repertory movie theater in Manhattan that plays old movies. And I used to love going there. And they used to get The Onion. It would be out on display. But the badge of honor to me is, just like The Onion, I don't think there's a single Kayfabe news story that goes out that you don't start getting all these people that think it's real and true. And then other people going, well, can't you tell this is satire? What's wrong with you? You never heard of the Kayfabe news? It's like the same thing that happens with every story The Onion publishes, no matter how ridiculous it is. The same thing happens with Kayfabe News. People get taken in by it, which I don't. Yeah, I know it's not your intention. I think.
It's not really. It's one of the side. It's like the icing on the cake when people buy it. And you know, some stories, I'm like, I hope people fall. Like this one's just believable enough. But most of them, I'm like, no one's going to believe this. The joke is so obvious. But some people let jokes just sail right over their heads. You know, there's actually a subreddit called Not Kayfabe News. It's modeled after a subreddit called Not the Onion, where people post real life stories that are bizarre enough to have been in the Onion. Well, someone created one that's wrestling stories that are bizarre enough to possibly have come from Kayfabe News. A few of them have gone actual viral, where they broke out of the wrestling bubble on the internet and broke into the mass pop culture bubble. So
are you talking about Kayfabe News stories that have done that?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, The Onion does it a lot, but Kayfabe News, on a few occasions. I remember when Hulk Hogan won his enormous lawsuit against Gawker and bankrupted them. You know, he got awarded $120 million or something crazy. And so as that news broke, I just posted a Kayfabe News story that said, Hogan buys WWE. Just three words, Hogan buys WWE. And the joke is just that with this huge windfall, you could just buy WWE like that. But it was believable enough. Well, that's Hulk Hogan. And people know Hulk Hogan. They know he just built. So it leapt off of the wrestling forums onto like the main, it was the top story on Reddit. And had, you know, there was actual debunkings of it, even though it's just so, if you only have to read two or three more lines of any given article.
Yeah, people don't do that.
Yeah, I know. That's the beauty of it.
I could see that happening with that particular one and I remember that one, because the joke itself is not really built into the headline. So if, for example, you are unaware of that Gawker lawsuit, you're going to see that and take it at face value. Yeah. But unless you look at where it's coming from, that's the thing. Yeah. If you don't know what Kayfabe News is or even what Kayfabe means, you know, that should be the giveaway, but it's not.
Yeah. I did one that it was borderline poor taste. But, you know, Eddie Guerrero was such a master of deception, of playing possum, that this was years ago. I did a story that he returned after 10 years of playing possum. And that only a master, like I tried to make it as flattering and sort of honor him. Only a talent such as his could have played possum this long and fooled everybody. And so most people saw it as like, ha ha. But in parts of the world, I guess where they don't have as much satire, I don't know, but in parts of the world, I saw numbers shoot through the roof. So in India, it was going viral, and in the Philippines, it was going viral. And so there was actual news outlets reporting on my, you know, saying a false news story is circulating the internet today, that it was, it's crazy. Yeah.
And again, all you have to do is read it in those cases. I know. To see how ridiculous it is. And it proves how
often.
That's
a tall order these days.
Right. It does prove how often people only read a headline. You can see that sometimes in the reaction to things. And that's even how clickbait works. You have outlets that are counting on people only reading the headline. And I wonder sometimes if maybe things get lost in translation, like you're talking about other countries. Maybe the humor and the satire is not communicated as well as you would like it to be. But you know, it's something that has really, really taken off. And also because it, you know, like The Onion, it's clever, it's smart. And people now, I mean, it's built such a following at this point. It's like, people look for what the Kayfabe News spin is going to be on anything that's kind of happening in wrestling to a certain degree. And there have even been, I have to say, I wish I could think of specifics, but there've been a couple of times, because I know how much people run with these stories, that I have seen one or two where I'll go, oh no, don't do that, because people are going to think that's true. Oh my God, this is going to create a giant mess, you know?
Yeah, this or the other one storm. I get a lot is people saying, don't give them any ideas. You know, I'll come up with some preposterous storyline idea, and it's preposterous, but just potentially believable enough that WWE could latch onto it. So people are often saying, no, don't let them. And occasionally WWE has taken Kayfabe News jokes and turned them into spots on TV. I remember one, it was like a Raw reunion episode, like one of those old school where they have a bunch of old guests back. And the day or two before that, I had published a story about Mae Young's baby hand. Maybe she gave birth to a hand in the stupidest storyline of all
Of
time.
course, of course.
But my joke was just that Mae Young's baby hand was all grown up now. And so I had a picture of a large hand. And the next Monday on Raw, Mae Young shows up on this Legends show, and then out pops a guy in a hand outfit, and he goes, "I'm Mae Young's baby hand. I'm all grown up now." And I was like,
Yep.
"Yes, I wrote a joke. I'm
There you
now
go.
an unofficial joke writer for WWE." It's not a very, it's such a corny, lame joke, but I like that they went with it. And I've talked to WWE former writers who would tell me that they would read kayfabe news in the writers' room and share stories and chuckle about them, and that they liked that it was never malicious
Right.
or, there's a lot of criticism of wrestling online, and I don't like to engage in that. There's a lot of complaining, and I don't like to engage in that.
And I think that's a good thing. And I think it's actually something that Kayfabe News does better than The Onion, because I find that The Onion does, especially in more recent years, as our political and public life has gotten more and more ludicrous and perverse, The Onion, because real life is resembling The Onion more than ever, has occasionally tried to like get on a soapbox and sort of pontificate about various topics. And even if I may agree sometimes or disagree, I always think like, stay in your lane. That's not really
Yeah.
what people come to the archive for, a kind of a self-righteous kind of
Yep.
response. And Kayfabe News never does that, thankfully.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. Donald Trump was a bit of a godsend because he's a WWE Hall of Famer and the most newsworthy person for years. So his involvement, I would get people, I'd make a joke about Donald Trump. And, I would make a joke about any WWE Hall of Famer who's in the
Right.
news every day. He happened to be the one. And people would say, "Oh, leave politics out of this." And I'm like, "Do you know what wrestling is? Do you know what these storylines are about? This
Right.
is politics, all of it. It's the human condition played out on a stage for you to, there's good guys and bad guys and corporations and evil and blue collar heroes. And I'm not going to leave wrestling out of it. That would be leaving the wrestling, leaving politics out would be like leaving out the guts of what makes wrestling wrestling."
Right. Well, yeah, sometimes people just miss the point on things like that. It's like the people who are always clamoring and demanding that any kind of like social or political message not be included in any work of art or entertainment. And these are people, I guess, who have no awareness of what art and entertainment is, or the
Yeah.
history of it, or anything
Or what
about
wrestling
it.
itself is doing. These are little
Right.
morality plays. All of them have a
Right.
message, and all of them want you to think a certain way. And it's all, that's what I love about wrestling in much the same ways as a Shakespearean play. It's built on this emotional crescendo and roller coaster. And you're supposed to, as a fan, feel slighted at times and pissed off. And it's all part of the journey.
Now, I may be off base here, but I also feel like Kayfabe News played a significant role in popularizing the whole meme of John Cena is invisible. Am I wrong on that? I feel like that it a lot of it came from there.
You know what? I can't take credit for that one. I've actually avoided Kayfabe News tends not to go there because it became a meme thing.
Right.
There are certain things that I feel like Kayfabe News pulled to the forefront. One of them was Vince McMahon's penchant for, quite frankly, I've just
God, yes.
I don't quote Vince McMahon without "quite frankly" on the beginning and the end of the sentence. And I noticed that nobody was really sort of picking on that until I started, at least I didn't notice. The John Cena thing, that wasn't me, but it John Cena was responsible for what I think, if I had to pick, like, what's my favorite kayfabe news story? It's the one, I know it's Mick Foley's favorite too, because he mentions it every time I see him. It's John Cena visits his injured self in the hospital. And so I just have a picture of John Cena in a hospital bed shaking John Cena's hand.
The ultimate make-a-wish visit, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
The Vince thing is hilarious. I do remember that because I thought I was the only one who noticed this. So for me, and this is also, I've spent time around him, I've interviewed him, but also just a fan growing up, watching him. There's three Vince phrases for me. There's "quite frankly," I would suggest that. He starts a lot with that. Well, I would suggest that, quite frankly. And the other one is things of that nature.
Of that nature.
He will say a lot. Well, quite frankly, I would suggest that things of that nature. Those are, you can't listen to a Vince interview where he doesn't use at least two, usually all three of those phrases and expressions. Really bizarre.
I think I did a kayfabe news story a while back. The headline was just, Vince McMahon speaks quite frankly about things of that nature.
Perfect. Perfect. I knew I wasn't the only one noticing this. But but back to the referee thing, because I like you, also find referees and what they do to be fascinating, because I think the sign, I think, of somebody who's only casually watching wrestling is that the people that don't catch on to how important the referees are, and how, in a lot of ways, it's almost like they represent the office in the ring while the match is going on. Like, they are the representative of the promoter or the booker or whatever in there. And, you know, so even when I worked at WWE and beyond, like, I've always had an interest in interviewing referees and in kind of picking their brain. One of my favorite interviews I ever did for WWE was with Dick Kroll, who was the really recognizable. He was like the really tall ref that used to always work the garden shows back in the day. And I mean, God, the stories that he would tell. And he would give me these crazy insights, like something I never forgot. And it's one of those things where you go like, oh my God, how did I not realize that? He would say, you know how you always used to see guys patting down wrestlers in the ring, and you don't really see it that much anymore. Like, it's not really done. He's like, here's why. He says to me, back in the day, before we had headsets in our ears and before the referees were even around, allowed to be around the wrestlers in the back, because we would be representing the commission or whatever, that was when we would be talking to each other and trying to get like, okay, so who's going over and what's the big spots I need to look for? What's the finish? And the wrestlers would be letting him know, so he knew what the hell was going on. He goes, that's why we used to pat him down. So like that kind of stuff, I flip over.
Yeah, me too. You know, I remember this moment when I was a kid. I was outside an arena where a WWF house show was happening, and I just watched the show, and there's these wrestlers and referees, and they're doing this magical thing in the ring. And then I see the referee come out and get in the ring truck and drive the ring truck. And I was like, but he's an official. He went to referee school, and he's a person of very high caliber. Why is he driving the ring truck? But of course, in reality, you know, I go and I set up the ring with the guys when I'm on a show, because I'm a lowly referee. That's what you do as a referee. There's so much behind the scenes, and you're right. Thankfully, I haven't iron refed a show, which is means you referee every match. Thankfully, I've done shows where we at least alternate one on, one off for matches. Right. So we have time backstage between matches to make sure we know the finish, make sure we know the main spots, make sure whatever we need to know. But I've done a couple back-to-back matches where I haven't seen the guys for a little while. So the pat down, I'm like, is everything the same? Everything good? Anything I need to know? Pat, pat, pat. And I'm the first time in training I did that pat down, the guy puts up his boot and I pat it, pat the knee pads, and I did it very perfunctorily. And my trainer was like, what the hell are you doing? I said, I don't know. I'm doing what they do on TV. He's like, check him for weapons. Be a referee. Like, don't just go through the motions. And so I feel the boot, but I also know that's my chance. I don't have to hurry to chat with the wrestler and just check to see if there's anything I need to know. And, you know, at indie shows, the stakes are fairly low in terms of timing. You're not beholden to TV times. So I haven't had an earpiece in, and I generally don't have to be giving time cues. But as you go up, if you're doing it even for an indie pay-per-view, you know, you're working at specific times. And so the referees essentially have to be the ones keeping the wrestlers on time, making sure that they are moving the show in the correct way. And like you said, being the promoter's liaison in the ring. I've been lucky that I've worked with wrestlers who are far more experienced than me. And I know that they know how to work to a time, and that they'll listen if something needs to change, and that nobody's going to grandstand. It's a pretty amazing experience to actually be in the ring and be part of it. There's times when I have to like snap myself back into the moment and like, oh, I have a job. I have to go. I have to count that pin. I can't just watch. I have to be down. But I'm like, where's the referee? Oh, it's me. I gotta go.
Right. What are you blind? Oh, wait a minute, it's me. Right. I think before they had the earpieces and things, that and probably and maybe even to still to this day on indie shows where they don't have all those resources, that was also the benefit of having those kind of obscure guys that would always be sitting at ringside and you always wonder, what the hell's that guy doing there? Like a timekeeper, quote unquote, or whatever. One of their roles was to signal the ref. You know, like I've been talking about it a lot on this show week to week because I'm writing a book right now about Gorilla Monsoon.
I
And
know, and
he.
I'm so I'm so excited about that. I
Thank
have
you.
many gorilla related questions for you someday.
But he used to produce, especially before Vince bought out the company, he used to produce the shows, the weekly TV shows. He would be like the man in charge, the producer, the main agent. And he also notoriously. Gorilla had very little patience for referees. He would get very frustrated with them. It's almost like he just wanted to get in there and do their job, which is why he did a lot of guest refereeing in his time. But he would,
You
they
can
would
hear
be,
that frustration on
oh,
commentary
yes, you
sometimes
can.
too.
He would let loose. He would really
Yeah.
lay into them, and that was
Because
legitimate.
I've been looking exclusively, like I've been putting my focus on referees, watching old footage, because I'm watching for referees that I know that were doing it back in the day. And yeah, Gorilla's on him. I didn't notice back as a kid, but he's quite adamant about the referees not being in the right place at the right time. And
So many things and little things that he would point out that it gives you insight into even how the shows were run. Like I remember one time, and this is something nobody would care about today or notice or pick up on. It's not even important. But he made a whole stink over the fact that the referee is supposed to be the first person in the ring for the match and the last person in the ring. Now, that's not done anymore now because the wrestlers always grandstand after their matches. But in the old days, the referee was supposed to stay in there until both wrestlers left the ring after the match. And this poor ref, you know, leaves the ring first. And Gorilla made a whole thing out of it, which you know that's him for real, because it doesn't serve the show in any way. It does nothing for the fan that's watching. It's Gorilla on mic criticizing the ref as he probably would have done if he was sitting in the gorilla position in the back. Not on the mic. You know,
Yeah.
it's really him doing that. But what I was going to say about him was in those old days when the referee, if they were screwing up in the ring and the ref really wasn't keeping track of time and things were getting out of hand, his last resort would be in the middle of the TV taping. He would walk out from the locker room, walk over to the ring and just go like, okay, wrap it up or something, or tap the ring or point to them and then walk back. The most obvious thing in the world, because he had no
Yeah.
other way of signaling them. You know, it's like
Yeah.
there was a story that he would take his glasses off or something. And if they saw him take his glasses off, they knew it was time to wrap it up. But like, let's say they couldn't see him or they missed it or something. He would just go
Yeah.
right out there and just say, okay, come on, let's wind this up.
What's funny is though, most fans, like I remember Gorilla was commentating on the first show I ever saw. It was Gorilla and Jesse Ventura. And if I were a fan watching that and Gorilla had just walked to the ring and the match had ended and he walked back, in my head, I would have thought, oh my God, that's Gorilla Monsoon. And what's he doing here? What storyline is this going to turn into? And then, of course, you'd forget a week later or 10 minutes later.
Right.
So, you know, in those days, I think the fans would go, ooh, what's Gorilla Monsoon doing here? And,
You wouldn't
or just, yeah, not even.
always put it together, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
When they did the angle with, because I was writing about this recently for a magazine article, like a retrospective, when they did the angle about where Larry Zbyszko turns on Bruno Sammartino, the famous heel turn, it's like, you know, one of the most famous ever. They played it so serious because Bruno's laying in the ring in a pool of blood, literally. He's been laid out with this wooden chair. The officials come out. But also, who comes out is Gorilla Monsoon in street clothes, you know, just coming out from the gorilla position, fans not even knowing what his role is, and, you know, just the gravity of it. where it's this weird thing. Like, if you knew he was the producer, which I can't imagine fans would know, you would realize what a big deal that was, that even he was out there trying to help Bruno out. But even not knowing he was the producer, then you get this feeling of like, wow, this is a really big deal. Why is Gorilla Monsoon out there? You know, there was like, there was a layer to it.
Yeah. I like to think of, you know, people like us, we talk about wrestling and we talk about it with other people who know wrestling. And so I think I remind myself sometimes that every show I'm at, there's got to be some first timers who have never seen wrestling live before. And maybe haven't seen it since their dad forced them to watch it when they were five. Right. So someone's dragged a newcomer to a wrestling show. And you have to look at all of those moments from that two-pronged perspective. What are the fans going to think of all this? The people who know all the stuff. And then what are the first-timers going to think? And a spot like that with Gorilla, well, you know, a first-timer would go, well, that giant mountainous man in a suit and the tinted glasses has come out. He must be something important. And of course, the nerds would say, oh God, it's Gorilla, the producer.
Right. So, this was not supposed to happen, you know. Like, yeah. I think that's what they were going for, that whole like, oh my God, if one of the big wigs of the show is out here, this might be a genuine thing we're seeing happen here. Like, that's that game that wrestling plays.
But, I had a moment like that in refereeing that, so I've interviewed Earl Hebner for this movie. The ref didn't see it. I should mention the ref
moved up.
So I was talking to Earl Hebner for it, because if you're going to do a movie about referees, you got to talk to Earl Hebner. And I told him that as a kid, I saw him in a house show match, and it was him and Ric Flair. I think it's Ric Flair and Bret Hart, and he was reffing. And he and Ric Flair got into a shoving match. And as a kid, what I didn't know is that they did that every night in every town. And Hebner would shove Flair back and get a huge pop. But as a kid, you don't have the internet. I didn't have it. Nobody had the internet then. And you wouldn't travel from town to town. So I thought I had seen something truly unique, a referee putting his hands on a wrestler and vice versa. And I was like, I can't believe this. And it was all these years later that I saw Earl, and he's like, yeah, we did that all the time. Yep.
I think that was a big Flair thing, because he used to do that in the NWA with Tommy Young. And that was his thing. They would shove each other back and forth. And there was like some really aggressive reffing, because then you would see the guys like, and I guess this really wasn't done in the WWF that much, but like, for example, if a heel grabbed the ropes to break a hold, which back then was a totally heel move to do, it was cowardly. Baby faces didn't do that. But if a heel grabbed the rope intentionally, you would sometimes see the referee knock their hand off the rope as if to say, no, don't do that. You're not getting out of the hold that way. You gotta figure out how to get out of this hold, you know. But then you'd have referees that would call it, okay, you touched the rope, we got to break the hold. There was this whole level of how much should the referee intervene on the side of justice in this match, you know?
Yeah. And I love that there are so many gradients of that just in the refereeing. This is where I had to dive into it to even realize it, that there are referees who they're small and they're fast and they're everywhere and they're going to be exactly in position and be super professional. I'm 6'3" and 47 years old. So, you know, I'm not lightning quick and I'm not going to be out of the way. But what I can do is be a kind of referee who does get between guys, and I can throw my weight around a bit because I have a bit of a size advantage. And so I have to lean into the fact that I'm built a certain way, and so I should ref a certain way. But also, the promotions I'm reffing for, some of them are mostly hardcore matches. And so if I start applying the rules the way I would in a technical match at some hardcore show, it just doesn't work. So
right.
Within the parameters of your... And no, I don't think any referee should really have a character. They should just have versions of referee. And so I'm sort of the version of a referee who's a bigger guy, bit more authority figure, just because I'm an older guy, I got some gray hair. But there are, you know, other people that we're profiling in this movie. Well, Harry D is a Canadian ref. He's sort of a legend of 30 years. And he's not tall like me, but... He's really fit. He's ripped. And you would believe that he could get guys apart. But there are other referees who are much smaller. Their advantage is that they make the guys look enormous. They make the wrestlers look big by comparison. But they don't have the same advantage of size that that I do, so they may have to be stricter with the rules and like really threaten
Right.
disqualification, whereas I can get in their face and like pull the shirt up and say, I'm the one wearing the stripes
Right.
here, you listen to me. So through sort of trial and error, mostly through pretend met, well, they're all kind of pretend, through mock matches at the wrestling school, I've had to realize that I've sort of had to find my voice, and my voice is a bit, I'm a bit more in people's face and yelling more and kind of angry when the rules are being broken. But a lot of refs are sort of more by the books. Like, you've got that five count and I'll give you till five. I'm like, you better break that hold by five or I'm kicking, I'm right up in
Right.
their face.
I think we need more of that. I mean, I think that's something that, the conventional wisdom with the referee always was, yes, okay, yeah, we know it's a work. Yes, you're not an actual official. Yes, wrestling doesn't have actual rules in a book, but you have to create the illusion that you're in charge in there. Get in their faces, yell at them, tell them what to do. I feel like, and I try so hard to avoid criticizing specific companies, but and I don't know how much this comes up in your film, but I get very frustrated, for example, with AEW, and I know I'm not the only one. I feel like their referees are not told to do that. Their referees, and WWE is still, they're not perfect, but they're much better at this. But in AEW, the referees are completely neutered. Like, they just stand there and watch things going on. They don't even pretend that they're trying to stop it or break it up, or, they're just there to count a three count. Guys will be doing these ridiculous hand. The worst things is in tag team matches where it's like a parent who has lost control of, like a giant sleepover. And you have all these. The wrestlers that no one's tagging, at a certain point, they just give up on tagging. They're all in the ring together. They're outside the ring, and the referee's just standing there. And I feel like, at least in WWE, still not as much as they used to, but the referees are still sort of like they're in there. They're letting the wrestlers know, even if the wrestler ignores them and no-sells them, that's not their fault. They're in there letting the fans know, I am the official here. And that makes it hard sometimes for me to watch AEW, not to get too much into current wrestling, but the refereeing is very important to me. I don't know how
No,
you feel
I
about
agree
that. I don't want to
completely.
put you on the spot,
No,
if you.
I agree completely. There is a time for the referee to completely lose control of this thing. The
Yes.
referee's in control. Mayhem has broken loose. And that should come after the establishment that the referee is an authority figure, and that the authorities, that authority figure, that what he says means something. So if the cheating begins immediately and there's no repercussions, then again, I always think of the first time fan. They need to, the referee is their envoy to even know what's allowed and what isn't. You to know what is cheating, you have to know what the rules are. To know that the heel is being is breaking the rules, you have to know essentially what those rules are. And so the referee is part of conveying that message to the audience, especially if the audience is new to wrestling. But there's also the time, I love it. Some referees are very good at losing control of a match. So they will see that this mayhem is breaking loose and they're trying, they're rushing one guy out of the ring, then they're rushing the other guy out of the ring. Then they throw their hands up in the air and essentially say, screw it. And that's the moment when the referee has made a, you can see they've made a decision, I'm going to allow this because the fans are into it.
Or sometimes they might at that point call for the bell and throw the match out and just say, this is out of control. They've made that decision.
And
But
so
I.
I think what happens in that moment is important. The referee, I don't know if they should lose control completely or be so pushed, they say, all right, I'm going to allow it, right?
Right.
Hockey referees will allow, maybe not anymore, I don't watch it, but there were times you'd see the fight would go on for a while until it was time to break them up. That
Right.
was for sheer entertainment value.
Oh, of course. Yeah, of course. I mean, God, we had a minor league hockey team up here. I never saw, well, maybe this is done more often than I think, where they clearly were having worked hockey fights. I mean, absolutely 100% worked. I know a work when I see one, and these hockey fights were worked. But anyway, that's neither here nor
Well,
there.
when you see a off the t you know a springboard Hurricane Rana in a hockey fight,
Well, not that bad,
the fix is in.
but I think, like, the referees, and this also speaks to you were talking about hardcore matches and how you have to kind of like work it a different way. One thing I notice, and you probably have seen this too, if you're watching older wrestling to get a feel for how they used to do it, in the old days, if you had a match that was no DQ, anything goes, right? Like, if you have that match now, the referee literally can, might as well just go take a smoke break. Like, he just sits in the corner, and he'll just be like, well, okay, you're trying to cut this guy's arm off with a machete. Ah, well, it's a no DQ match. I guess I just have to sit here and let this go on. In older matches, even in a no DQ situation, the referee would still be getting in there to try to assert control. Like, let's say you brought a steel chair in the ring. Very often, the referee would still try to get it away from you or would still try to warn you not to use it. Now, in your head, you're thinking, well, wait a minute, it's a no DQ match. What? But the thinking was, yes, I no longer have the power to disqualify you in this match. I cannot end this match, but I'm still going to try to stop you from killing this man.
Because you can be the voice of decency.
Right.
So,
but it preserved the illusion, too, because it made you believe. If I see a guy just standing there watching another guy just get almost murdered, I think to myself, okay, this is a show. But if I see a referee going like, wait a minute, this is too far. You can't do this. You can't do that. Yeah. That lets me know, hey, wow, this feels real to me now. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I refereed a match just this past Saturday night, and it was a hardcore match. So they're using the usual tools, the kendo stick and chairs and stuff in a nice, entertaining way. And so there was no disqualifications, but my role, you know, they come into the ring and it looks like they're going to lock up and they lock up. And then one of the heel bails and starts grabbing weapons from under the ring. So I'm screaming at him, come on. And it's a small enough venue that if I'm loud enough, I'm saying things like, these people want to see wrestling. They don't want to see that. Come on, bring it in. And I'm telling him to like, I'm begging him like, no, he's setting up a piece of plywood to throw the guy through. I'm like, you don't need to do this. You don't need, he's already just pinned him.
And so I'm
trying to be the one, like, even though there's nothing I can do to disqualify him, I'm trying to be the voice of like, no, you're going too far. You don't need to do this. Be a sport, you know, make it a contest. And those are kind of fun to ref because you do have to make yourself busy.
Right. That's it. You have to give, you should always, and that's such a fine line. Like you said, a referee shouldn't be a character. I think sometimes referees put themselves over too much. They sell too much. Like I see referees that react to every body slam and suplex. And I'm going, dude, you're a referee. You're supposed to be jaded. You've seen this a million times. It has to be very grievous for you to sell it. Like, you're not going to cringe at every body slam. You've refereed 1,000 matches. So you got to walk that line where you're not putting yourself over, but at the same time, you have to be looking like you're doing something at all times. You don't want to steal the show. You don't want people to be watching you instead of the wrestlers, but you got to look like there's some role you're playing there.
Usually that something, you know, during the course of the matches, I'm staying low. I'm sort of, and I'm just trying to watch, you know, if it's a wrist lock, I want a view of the wrist. And if it's a headlock, I want a view of the neck. But I also, you know, the referee, the last thing you want is the referee's butt on camera. So you have to be highly aware of where the hard cam is and where the roaming cameras are. So I want to be subliminal for most of the match. Like there's a set of black and white stripes over there, and they represent the rules, and the rules come swooping in when they need to, and then they just vanish into the periphery, which is great. You know, it's one of the referees told me, you know, there are Oscars for supporting actor, you know, and that's essentially what the referee is. There's three people in the ring. The charade doesn't really work without the ref. Like, you can kind of do it, but who's going to count the pins? Who's going to admonish the heel for breaking the rules? Who's going to, you know, break the hold when the baby face is just about to quit, but it reaches the ropes, you know, and forces the heel off. I love thinking about it as a supporting role. And the last thing a supporting role actor should do is eat up the scenery or try to steal the show. It's literally the opposite of what the supporting that's not supporting.
No upstaging. One of the things, I interviewed Mike Chioda and Jimmy Corderas for the Gorilla book, because they were both brought into the company by Gorilla and mentored by him and all this. And they talked about how Gorilla would talk about it like a horseshoe. This is how he would explain it to them. The hard camera is facing you, recording you, so you need to move in a horseshoe that faces the camera. So, you know, you're moving around the wrestler, but never in front, as much as you could avoid it. You think of it like as this horseshoe where the open end of the horseshoe faces the hard cam, you know?
That's actually, you know, I'd never heard that until I started training to be a ref. And then a few refs, I just heard throwing around this term, you know, you just got to work the horseshoe. And I was finally, I said, what's the horseshoe? And sure enough, you know, usually if there's a hard cam, but often it's just, where is the most audience? Where are the most eyeballs? And that's exactly where I don't want to be. So I find myself, yeah, I work the horseshoe. And occasionally I have to cross that gap in the horseshoe, but I run across it. And it's not because, like, in a split second I'm going to ruin anything, but it's mental training, because the horseshoe points a different direction depending on the venue you're in. The hard cam could be off to your, you know, to the right of the audience or anything. Did you ever watch Arrested Development?
Yes.
The Buster, the sort of awkward son, we went to a school where they teach you how to not be seen or heard, the school for young boys to not be seen or heard. And so he's always just around the corner, you know, just peeking. So I feel like the referee in many ways has to be a master of not being seen or heard, which means also not getting run over by large wrestlers who you're always anticipating one or two steps ahead. You have to learn when a wrestler is feeding in one direction, what direction that means they're going to go if they've taken a head scissors or a body slam. And as a fan, your eyes always go to where the wrestlers are. And as a referee, you have to train your eyes to go where the wrestlers aren't. And the hardest part is to do the most essential thing that a referee does, which is not see the essential cheating that happens behind your back. Because I didn't realize this till I tried it. There is no force stronger than the urge to turn around to see what's happening behind you when you hear a bunch of ruckus.
Sure.
And you're like, I know what's happening, but I'm not ready to turn yet because the manager is still jaw-jacking me. So I just rewatched a match that I reffed. And thankfully, I've never actually seen the cheating that I wasn't supposed to see. Like, I missed it in all the right ways. I took the bump at the right time. But man, that compulsion, when you're the ref and 90%, 99% of the time you're watching like a hawk, because really you're looking for, well, ostensibly you're looking for a choke or an eye gouge or a hair pull. So you're always like, and then in those crucial moments when a manager happens to get up on the apron, you're absolutely deaf and blind to the mayhem.
Yes. Even
you.
When people are screaming at you to turn around, people in the crowd, like that adds to it too. Not only are you tempted, you have people literally screaming at you to turn around. And that's the other thing they call it. They call it burying the ref, which you see a lot, unfortunately, today, where the guys don't even know enough to do it in a way that it's not like right in front of the guy, because then you put the ref in this weird position. Like, what's he going to do? He may have to call for the DQ, even though that wasn't the finish. It's like you've put him in this spot now where he's got to either pretend he didn't see what he clearly saw. And it just makes the referee, I mean, yeah, referees are always going to look blind and dumb and all this stuff. But there's a line where you don't want him to look like he's just a complete moron, you know, like he's got to have some teeth, you know.
But my favorite thing at wrestling shows, you know, before every show, there's a meeting where the promoter goes over the matches. And often the promoter will say something like, don't make your referees look stupid, you know. If your referees look smart and they look like they're on their game, then everything you do will be more meaningful. So, like, if you're going to cheat, get the referee distracted somehow. Don't do it in front of them, because, yeah, then the illusion is broken. The keeper of the rules is now a eunuch who can no longer enforce them.
Right. So the movie, I got to mention more about that, because you mentioned the website and stuff, but the ref didn't see it. What can you tell people about how it came about, and also how people can find out about it?
So they can find out at therefmovie.com. And there's some trailers and clips on YouTube. It came about really, I told you that when I was a kid, I noticed the referee driving the ring truck and doing things that I didn't expect a referee to do. And it was one of those moments where something clicks. And I thought, wrestling, I knew the matches were fixed, but you never really know what's going on behind the curtain. It's like I've always loved magic too, magic and illusions, and I want to know how the tricks are done. I don't, it's not enough for me to watch the magic show and say, oh, that was neat. I want to figure out all the tricks. And it's the same with wrestling. I want to know how they put this thing together. And I realized that, there's a lot of wrestling documentaries, a lot of really good wrestling documentary content, Dark Side of the Ring and Tales from the Territories, and tons of documentaries, and a lot of not so great ones too, but none about the referees, the supporting character. You've got lots of documentaries about the stars, and never one about the supporting character who is in every single wrestling match you've ever seen. There's been the guy in the stripes or the blue shirt and the bow tie or whatever the outfit is. So, given my background in journalism and my interest in telling stories that don't normally get told, I was a newspaper writer for years and I didn't really have a beat. I found the stories in the cracks between everybody else's beats, like the interesting human interest stories. And the same compulsion made me want to focus on the referees simply because it's never been done. I don't think there should be 15 documentaries about referees, because they are not the star, but they certainly deserve a bit of the spotlight.
Yeah, no, I
Yeah.
agree. Like for all the reasons I've been talking about here, it really is like they're in a lot of ways the people that are almost calling the match. It's like in a weird way how the, I'm a big baseball fan too, and how the catcher is sort of this figure that a lot of people don't realize how much control they have over the game because they're guiding the pitcher along. They're helping to decide what pitches get thrown and why. And I mean, in a lot of ways, they're sort of the arbiter. They're almost like the pitcher's boss or something. Like it's,
Yeah.
like they'll call the pitcher over when they need to. And I feel like the referee is that way where it's like, on the surface, you don't realize it, but in a lot of ways, they're kind of controlling the ebb and flow of a match. Just as much as the guy who's calling the mat, the wrestler who's calling it, he really is. It's the cliche is so true. He's the third man in the ring, very, or the third person in the ring, very, very in truly in the sense of he's the third performer in the ring,
Yeah, no, it's been quite amazing to experience it firsthand and even see not just in the ring but as part of a show, because the referee typically, if a show is two referees, they'll alternate matches. And so on the show I ref this past weekend, there was a spot that I knew because I was refereeing both matches. I knew they both had the same spot in mind. Which is not great for an indie. You don't want to repeat spots ideally. So they try not to step on each other's toes. And so I said to the guys in one match, oh, the main event is planning to do that spot. And they were like, oh, great, we'll do something else. And so because I had visibility to more of the show than just my pieces of it, I could sort of help craft the show as a whole, not just an individual match, but build that audience journey. It's man, it's very satisfying, and as a wrestling fan, it is by far the best seat you can get in the house. I've sat front row ringside before, but that's not where, nowhere even close to being in the ring.
Right, no.
There's a lot to remember and a lot to do. The funny thing is there are rules. You have to enforce them as if you basically you are a real referee enforcing real rules, and you're pretending to be a referee. And these rules do exist, and you're enforcing them, but not with the end in mind that the audience ultimately is supposed to think. It's
Right. Yeah, it's the illusion. It's like
yeah.
what I like to say sometimes, the biggest illusion about professional wrestling is that it's not professional wrestling.
Yeah.
It's not the professional version of the sport of wrestling. It's a completely different thing that
Yeah.
evolved in a completely different way. And so it's like when you've got a business that's built on so much illusion that the actual thing that it calls itself is not what it actually is. That's one of the most fascinating things about wrestling. And
It's, I keep thinking of these wrestlers. The more time I spend around them, the more I realize that they're just theater kids in spandex, with muscles, but they're theater kids. They're acting kids. And, getting involved in being a referee, I've actually said to some friends, maybe I'll get involved in a community play. Maybe I'll try acting, like, because now I've got the bug. I can see how fun it is. I'm playing a referee. That's a fun role. Maybe I could play other roles too.
Right. Well, that's great.
And I never wanted to be a wrestler, due to my dislike for pain and sweating. It turns out that being a ref, I've had to actually, up my exercise game and eat better and stop drinking. And it's a lot of work, especially if you're doing multiple shows on a or multiple matches on a show.
Sure, you got to move. I mean, you hear even sometimes about the referees getting taken out with injuries. I mean, Tommy Young, we mentioned him before. He was a very energetic, athletic ref. He'd leap over the guys sometimes to get to the other side. And I think that's how he hurt himself, because I think he did that spot and he wound up slipping out of the ring or something, and he messed his knee up, and that's kind of what retired him, because he was so physical as a referee.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it is,
Yeah.
it's a physical job.
Yeah.
Well,
It's so much
Colin,
fun.
I can't thank you
Highly
enough for,
recommend
yeah, right. Let's all become referees. No, I should try.
it.
I've done ring announcing, I've done commentating, not refereeing, and at 49, not planning to start. My knees already feel like they're like, little bags of pebbles at this point. So no, but
Is
no.
hard on the knees.
Yeah, God, I can't even just getting up out of bed these days is like a 50-50 coin toss. But Colin, again, thanks this for having such a wide ranging for humoring me through such a wide range of topics. I knew when I was going to talk to you, I said, okay, well, I want to talk about wrestling magazines. I want to talk about kayfabe news. I want to talk about refereeing. How often do I get to talk about refereeing? And we did it all. We got to it all. So thank you for that, for going with it.
Well, thank you. It's an absolute pleasure. I've been looking forward to it.
There you have it, folks. My conversation with Colin Hunter. Thanks for listening, and thanks so much to Colin for being my guest on Shut Up and Wrestle this week. Next week on the show, we are turning our attention to the Pacific Northwest, because my guest will be Portland wrestling historian Mike Rogers. We'll be talking with him and about the work he's been doing, taking a look at Portland wrestling history next week on Shut Up and Wrestle. Other guests that are lined up in the weeks to come, I've got Chris P. Lettuce, the curator of so much wrestling history in video form. He will be a guest on Shut Up and Wrestle. I've also put together a very special employee roundtable, a WWE employee roundtable, which I think you're going to find fascinating. It includes three of my great friends and former co-workers, Deb Jasway, who was, of course, a guest here a couple of years back from the Creative Services Department, Lou DiPietro, who was a WWE.com editor on the road, and Director of Security, Jimmy Noonan. We all sat together and talked about our experiences working at WWE, the corporate culture, the culture on the road, that sort of thing. It's a very illuminating conversation that I think you're going to appreciate. That's coming up in the weeks to come. Other future guests include wrestling journalist Dominic D'Angelo, my good friends from the Whip Show podcast, as well as Pro Wrestling Illustrated contributor and red carpet interviewer extraordinaire Candice Cordelia. So do keep listening to Shut Up and Wrestle. You can find us in so many places. Our website is suawpod.com. Additionally, the show can be found wherever you get your podcasts: Spotify, Google Podcasts, Podcast Addict, Podbean, Apple Podcasts, and the rest. While you're at it, join the Facebook group Shut Up and Wrestle with Brian R. Solomon. We will be happy to have you there. Also, if you'd like to contribute to the show in a financial manner, you may do so in a couple of ways. It is a free show, of course, but you can still show your appreciation. On my Twitter profile, Brian R. Solomon, you'll find a contribution button there that you can use to contribute via Cash App or Venmo. And if you'd like to use PayPal, you can find me on there at BrianRSolomon@yahoo.com. And thanks to those who have already done so, it is greatly appreciated. There's lots of other places where you can find my work. The Wrestling News from Arcadian Vanguard. Find it every single morning at thewrestlingnews.com, where you can also subscribe to it. and you can find it on the Arcadian Vanguard YouTube page. My books, Blood and Fire, the unbelievable real-life story of wrestling's original Sheik, and Superheroes, the history of a pop culture phenomenon from Ant-Man to Zorro. Find them wherever books are sold, or if you would like to purchase a signed copy from me, reach out to me at brianrsolomon@yahoo.com. The magazines that I write for, as I mentioned at the top of the show, Inside the Ropes magazine, you can get at insidetheropesmagazine.com. Pro Wrestling Illustrated, you can get at pwi-online.com. If you're looking for me on social media, you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at Brian R. Solomon. On Facebook, my author page is Brian Solomon Writer. And on any of those social media platforms, you'll find the link to my author website on the World Wide Web. Shut Up and Wrestle is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And as always, this has been Brian R. Solomon asking you to keep those cards and letters coming in and reminding you to never take a ride from a three-legged camel. So long, wrestling fans.